Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to Game Buoy, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Shiver me timbers!
Now, are you sure you want your shivers timbered? Wait, I got that backwards. I thought you were going to say scissor me timbers.
No, I'm not a lesbian.
Are you sure about that?
I think so.
So this week on Game Buoy, episode 13, we're going to talk a little bit about gaming in Japan. This is a point that we kind of hit last week, and we realized we really have a lot to talk about on the subject.
True dat.
First, though, you know, we've been working on making our show sound better for you folks. And we just want to thank you guys for keeping up with us as we do our best to keep things on track. And, you know, hopefully things are getting better every week. If you have any issues or concerns, you think maybe we don't sound as good as we used to, please, please reach out and let us know. Thank you so much. And with that, I think it's time to tear into things. What do you think?
I think that sounds like a great idea. So, Captain Spike, got any follow-ups for us this week?
As a matter of fact, we do. Obviously, you know, we've been talking a lot about the Wii U here on Game Buoy. We're very excited about the Wii U here in Pirate Studios. And following Nintendo's latest earnings presentation, Satoru Iwata-san addressed several topics in an investor Q&A session involving Wii U marketing strategy, the difficulty of selling games based on new IP, the impact of, you know, smartphones on console sales. And this whole thing, it's super interesting. I'd really recommend everybody read the entire article. We have Joystick's take on it posted on our website. Obviously, if you're listening to our podcast, you probably got it over at GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
But I thought that it was super, super, super interesting that Nintendo more or less acknowledged that they didn't acknowledge directly that the Pikmin 3 delay is just a matter of preventing another software drought from happening, but it's pretty strongly implied that that's what's going on. I believe the exact quote is, "Nintendo tends to release too many titles at the launch of a hardware system, and as a result, suffers a drop in new games for quite some time after launch. And for the Wii U launch, we are being very careful not to let that happen."
Excellent.
So, I think that's good. They're aware that this whole drought thing, you know, it's practically a meme at this point. You know, LOL software drought. Hi, DS. Hi, 3DS. Hi, Nintendo 64. Hi, GameCube. Hi, Wii. And, you know, with the Wii U, Nintendo seems to be thinking they're not going to do that. They're not going to let that happen, and they're being proactive about it. And I think that, if anything, is really the important thing to take from this. Nintendo seems to be being super proactive about, like, fixing perceived problems in their strategy, and I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, and this works for me. And, like, you know, I can't afford to buy a ton of games at once, so, I mean, spacing them out just makes more sense for me as a consumer. So, you know, I mean, I'm, as much as it would be cool to have, like, Pikmin 3 and, you know, some of these other titles that aren't going to be coming out at launch, you know, we'll get them eventually. We know they're coming. So, you know, in the meantime, there's already going to be plenty, I'm sure, that will keep me busy as far as Wii U's concerned. So, sounds good to me.
Excellent.
Sounds like they're trying to be smart about their business decisions, unlike some companies we know, like Sony.
Yeah. So, that's pretty interesting anyway.
Agreed.
In any event, I think it's time for
news. 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 Oh my god, news. Oh my god, news.
So, our first news story here, and this is a little shady.
It's also a little bit silly, but
Virtue's Last Reward came out this past week. There's a pretty good chance that if you're the kind of person who listens to this show, you probably are familiar with that game and what it's all about, along with, you know, its predecessor, 999. What you might not be aware of is that Amazon and Axis Games had a really, really neat pre-order bonus lined up for pre-orders for Virtue's Last Reward. And that is, it was a replica watch of the watch that is present in 999 and Virtue's Last Reward. I don't want to say anything about the watch in case you haven't played these games yet, but intend to, as, you know, story is sort of the whole point. But basically, the pre-order item was undersupplied, and as a result, a lot of people are getting their games and not getting their, you know, rubber replica watches.
And you would think that wouldn't be such a big deal, but...
Yeah, the thing is, people were kind of figuring this was going to happen, so everyone's been reaching out to Amazon and Axis to be like, hey, you guys have taken so many pre-orders for these games, and you said quantities were going to be super limited. Are we all still going to get these? And repeatedly, Amazon and Axis both were telling people, like, no, we definitely are not over pre-ordering. We definitely have enough of these trinkets to give to everyone who has pre-ordered.
And then they blew it.
They blew it. So, you know, there's not much more to it than that, unfortunately. This is still sort of unfolding. But I think it's whack, yo. Like, I don't really like this.
Yeah, I mean, especially if I had pre-ordered it and, like, been super excited for it, like all these people. I mean, it doesn't personally affect me, but, you know, I would be pissed if I didn't get a pre-order bonus. So, you know, hopefully they can do something to rectify the situation, and we'll just kind of have to see. But, shame on you, Amazon and Axis. Shame on you. But we have some happier news to report as well this week, don't we?
Maybe. I don't. This, to me, could go either way. I'm not strongly for or against. But Phoenix Wright 5, it turns out, is going to be fully voiced.
Objection! No, I actually don't object to that. I just wanted to,
Of course you did. That's the meme. And to me, it's interesting because, you know, all of the big Phoenix Wright scenes and sayings were voiced. Like, there is a voice clip for Objection! As, you know, people who have played the game probably know. It doesn't really sound like the voice I just made, but that's okay. So I don't know how to feel about this. I thought the games were all right without being fully voiced, but by the same token, I guess it couldn't hurt. Outside of, you know, inflating the budget for the game, I guess. But as a consumer, that's not really in my view. For the product that we're going to get, I think probably some people are going to be super happy, and some of us are going to be, you know, more or less ambivalent.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people, especially the ones who are, like, on board with the series, like, since the beginning, you know, they were going to play it anyway, so it's just like, oh, cool. Now, make it come out now so we can play it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting because I saw this this news on Joystick. So, of course, that's whom we'll be linking to because they ran the story first. And they, in their post, had expressed concerns that Capcom may not be releasing the game worldwide, you know, in U.S., EU territories. But I'm pretty sure, and I believe we have even talked about this in the past, Capcom is already committed to a worldwide release for this title.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm stoked.
Well, it's good that Capcom's doing something right.
Yeah, you know, it's they don't do as many things right these days as they used to.
Yeah, and you know, we're kind of going to touch on that today, so
it's
probably a good time to move into our discussion topic, isn't it?
I think it probably is.
So, Captain Spike, do you want to explain to our listeners what our kind of our spin is going to be this week?
Well, we've been thinking a lot about how the gaming industry has changed. And, you know, we're largely thinking about this in the context of Japanese studios. Obviously, we're always thinking about this with regard to all studios. But for the purpose of this episode and not having this be a four-hour-long episode, we're just going to focus on three big publishers/developers. And we're going to look at sort of three different eras of, their business model.
Yeah, kind of just like snapshots in time.
Yes, yes, and that's a good way to put it. And so we want to start off, of course, with Namco Bandai. And I apologize if I seem a little disjointed here. I'm having some technical issues that we're working through, but little different from doing the show than usual. Anyway, I think Slagkick has something to say about Namco Bandai circa 1992.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when we think of Namco, we think of them, you know, kind of dominating the arcade business. And when we're looking back, you know, 20 years ago, I feel old now, but, you know, they just recently bought out Atari's arcade division, and, you know, they're kind of reaching into the arcade management business in the U.S., and a few years after this, a year or so later, actually, they ended up buying Aladdin's Castle, if you're familiar with that chain that was formerly owned by Bally's, and they actually ended up being the biggest arcade operator in the U.S., so, you know, Namco, of course, getting their start with Pac-Man and other beloved arcade classics. But they actually had a pretty huge impact in the home console business for NES. And, you know, we're maybe looking a few years prior, but, you know, towards the end of the 80s, 40% of their annual sales were actually coming from NES games. And, you know, they a lot of those were like Pac-Man releases and other spin-offs or ports of their arcade titles, but they actually published the first two Megami Tensei games by Atlus, and, you know, of course that would later go on to spawn the Persona series.
Which is, you know, it's funny to me, and just as a quick sidebar, of course, the Persona series, interestingly enough, is way more visible in the U.S. than the actual Megami and Shin Megami Tensei games.
Right, right. So it was, you know, even though Atlus is doing that on their own now, it was Namco that made it possible in the first place. So, you know, at this point, you know, we're looking at 1992. It was still a little early for some of their more prominent series that we think of when we come from Namco. Ridge Racer, Tekken, the Tales series, and, of course, the Soul series or Soul Calibur. It's kind of interesting to think of Namco in the console business back then. They were actually Nintendo's first licensee, and they were able to do things like manufacture their own cartridges back then, just because they were the first licensee and they had a good relationship with Nintendo. But when they renewed that the licensing, Nintendo revoked a lot of their rights, so Namco kind of didn't react well to that. And they actually pledged a lot of support for Mega Drive, a.k.a. Genesis. And, you know, when you look kind of at the grand scheme of things, they did not really support SNES a lot. And that probably has a factor in it, you know?
You know, I hadn't really thought about that. You know, I think about how the first Tales game was a Super Nintendo game. And so I guess I just think about, oh, yeah, of course they were on board with the Super NES, but looking at this lovely table that you put together, and that would, of course, be a table as in a chart, not a table like something you could upend if you're unhappy, it really does look like Namco gave a lot more attention to the Mega Drive than the SNES.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even really think about that either, but, yeah, they really just probably didn't take well, because, I mean, and we'll talk about this a little later with some of our other big studios, big publishers. Nintendo, especially Nintendo of America, could be kind of bitchy back then, so we'll kind of touch on that a bit later. Now, I have to confess, I'm not as familiar with Bandai as a company, and of course now, you know, they are one and the same, but what was Bandai doing about 20 years ago?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, and I'm sorry, I'm sort of thinking about how to phrase this, because when I think of Bandai, I think of sort of like really mostly like licensed anime games. I know that I have a Hokuto no Ken import SNES game that they did. I have some import Dragon Ball games that I believe they did. I believe that they were licensing out. I don't believe that they were developing, but I believe they were licensing out for the Super Roboto Tyson games.
And you know, that makes sense, because Bandai, first and foremost, was like a action figure company, right? I mean, that was probably...
As I understand it, yeah. I mean, I must confess, I'm not terribly well-versed in the origins of Bandai. In fact, at this point in the game, I often don't even think of them outside of the context of their merger with Namco.
Right. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting, but unless you have anything else to think of circa 1992 for Namco or Bandai...
No, in fact, I'd just like to ask all of our listeners out there... what do you think of Bandai circa 1992? Does anyone out there have any particularly strong feelings on the matter?
Yeah, because I was trying to do some research, and I just really couldn't find a lot about what Bandai was up to. And, I mean, at least that we would really think immediately, like, oh yeah, well, I mean, this is what was going on.
You know, there was one game, I need to interrupt because I just was... able to get my computer to work long enough that I was able to get some information about something. There was a game, probably, you know, very few people have heard about it at this point, but Bandai published a game in the late 80s for the NES, so, you know, a little before 1992, but still certainly gives us insight to what Bandai was doing at that time. There was a game which I wanted to talk about last week when we were talking about sort of unsung hits. A game called Chubby Cherub.
Oh, so it was your life story?
Girl.
I'm kidding. Please tell us about Chubby Cherub.
It's awful and super good in that way that only Nintendo games can be. Just to read this blurb real quick that I'm looking at. Chubby Cherub is about a flying Cupid-like character who eats food and attacks enemies with hearts.
Okay.
It's about a flying naked baby that eats.
That sounds dreadful.
Apparently, the Japanese version is actually based on a Fujiko Fujio manga series titled Obake no Kyutaro. I actually don't know anything about that. I don't really know anything about this game outside of it was super awful and I loved it.
All right, then. So thanks, Bandai, for Chubby Cherub.
Yeah. So that's what Bandai was doing.
But also not thank you, I guess.
That's like the reverse of sorry, not sorry, right?
Pretty much.
Thank you, not thank you.
So, okay. So we were looking at about 1992 era. You know, it was still a couple years off for Namco for some of their big series. But if we look 10 years ago, back in 2002, Bandai had introduced the Swan Crystal that year, which is the third iteration, actually, of the WonderSwan handheld that, unless you're super familiar with Japanese handheld consoles, you might not be as familiar with the WonderSwan. But, you know, WonderSwan was actually pretty successful, in particular, the Wonderswan. In particular, the WonderSwan Color, which actually had estimated 8% market share. And, you know, it had a pretty low price point, 6,800 yen, which is about $60 here in the States, or at least at the time it was. So that probably helped it out. And WonderSwan Color also had ports of Final Fantasy I and Final Fantasy II, and those were pretty decent from what I understand.
Well, yeah, you know, and that's the interesting thing to me about the WonderSwan Color was that it had these really cool limited edition Final Fantasy bundles. And these ports were great. You know, you have to sort of think about this in context, but these were almost like Super Nintendo quality remakes on a portable before that was quite so commonplace as it became in a post Game Boy Advance world.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of the GBA, unfortunately, WonderSwan was discontinued in 2003, so shortly after our little snapshot of 02 here. And a lot of that, honestly, probably had to do a lot with the GBA. So
I would suspect so. Something I really want to make a plea out to our listeners in Radioland. Did you ever see a Wonderswan in the U.S.? I ask because both Slagkick and I seem to recall seeing these at hobbyist and toy shops, but I see no indication on the internet that that was a thing. Are we experiencing a shared hallucination, or is the internet wrong? I want to believe the internet is wrong. I'm sorry, go on.
You might just be thinking of Neo Geo Pocket, but probably not. I give you more credit than that. One little neat tidbit is that...
Bitch, I got a Neo Poke.
One neat little tidbit is that before the merger, because at this point, the merger had not happened yet with Namco and Bandai, but around this era of the WonderSwan, Namco put out a couple of its titles, including Mr. Driller on the WonderSwan. So that was kind of neat. But speaking of Namco... was still a year or so off from some of their great classics from that era. Feels kind of sad to think of a game from 2002 being a classic now, but about a year or so later, 2003, I believe, was the first Donkey Konga, which, of course, is just so much fun. If you've never played it, you need to try and find some congas somewhere. Please, it's amazing.
Donkey Konga.
So, I mean, just a great game. And, you know, it was the GameCube era that kind of where Namco started to support Nintendo again. Because, you know, after Nintendo was kind of bitchy in the early 90s era, you know, they did Donkey Konga. And then another great Namco title that came around about 2004, I believe, Katamari Damacy, of course.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, as you might guess, we are huge fans of the Katamari Damacy series here at Game Buoy.
Yeah, so, I mean...
So we have to bring that up, even though, obviously, it's a little out of the purview of this discussion, we still felt it was important to hit that footnote.
Yeah, I mean, because that was a pretty special addition to their family of games in that era. You know, of course, at this point, 2002, we'd already seen a couple of entries in Ridge Racer, Tekken, and the Tails series, and the Soul series. It's kind of interesting when you look at their releases for this era. They didn't really support Xbox as much, but then you have to consider, Xbox and Microsoft in general has never really had a big market share in Japan, so why would they?
Although they did put a surprising amount of effort into the... Soul Calibur 2 port for Xbox. Huh. And I know we're diverging just a little bit from sort of our stated intention of sticking to the years, but I think it's very interesting to note that Namco put a lot of work into Soul Calibur 2 for Xbox. You know, they worked with Todd McFarlane and included Spawn in that version of the game. Of course, along with the originally designed character Necrid, who was also in the GameCube and PS2 games. But their exclusive characters were different. They were not Spawn for those other characters. And there are a lot of people, including people whom play on the tournament circuit, that swear by the Xbox release of Calibur 2 as the most arcade accurate.
Interesting.
In terms of timings and what have you.
Huh. That's interesting. Any of your thoughts about decade ago for Namco or Bandai?
No, I think it was a really healthy, very prosperous time, especially for Namco. I think that they...
Yeah, definitely.
Really, you know, I don't have a lot to say about either of those companies as developers or publishers in the early 90s, but in the early 2000s, I really feel like they had both hit a really great stride. They had both made...
Right.
You know, really good progress on the Japanese marketplace.
I mean, arguably, that era was probably their most prosperous since, for Namco anyway, since their
inception, basically.
Since their arcade greatness of the early 80s. But, so we're gonna fast forward to the future now, I mean, the present day, rather. 2012. So right now, at this point, Namco Bandai has been a thing for 6 years, so they've celebrated their 6-year merger anniversary this
year. And that's crazy to me.
Yeah, and so, you know, not surprisingly, we're continuing to see a lot of Tekken, Soul Calibur, Tails games. But they've actually been putting out the Naruto games as well, which are very popular.
Well, you know, and there's an important distinction to make here. There were two Naruto games on the Xbox 360 that were both very popular in the U.S. that were not Namco designed or developed. They were actually done by Ubisoft, and my understanding is that they have more in common with, like, a Prince of Persia or Assassin's Creed-style game.
Not surprising, given that it's by Ubisoft.
And the more successful series, however, worldwide, that is in Japan and the U.S., was the initially PlayStation 3 exclusive, the Nerultimate Ninja Storm games, which I don't really know why you would name a game Nerultimate Ninja Storm, but they're very popular. These are, you know, million units plus selling games each iteration. Made or developed by CyberConnect 2, who you might be familiar with from making the game Asura's Wrath.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I don't know this for fact, but playing through Asura's Wrath, having played the Nerultimate, you know, games, which are typically in the U.S. just called, you know, Ultimate Ninja games, I would say that probably they have a lot of shared tech used between the two.
Hmm, interesting. So, something else to kind of point out about Namco Bandai in the present day, Wolf Team, also known as Namco Tales Studio, has just been absorbed by the parent company. I believe that was just last year, if I remember correctly.
You know, and I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that we're seeing Tales games, new Tales games, announced basically yearly now.
Yeah, I mean, Tales is still a pretty successful little series.
Yeah, not so much in the U.S.,
of course. We're, of course, talking about Tales, T-A-L-E-S. We are not talking about Tales, the Two-Tailed Fox, because he's a big fucking flop.
Nor would we ever. But, you know, the only ones that have been terribly successful in the U.S., as far as I know, were Tales of Symphonia for
GameCube. Yeah, of course. That, I mean, that's the big one.
Tales of Vesperia.
Ah, yes. I remember that.
Yeah. I'm not super into it myself, of course.
Yeah, I've never honestly paid too much mind to the Tales series, but, you know, people out there like it, so.
Yeah, I appreciate what they're laying down. It's not exactly for me, but it's cool. Anyway, yeah. I get the feeling there's something very specifically that you want to talk about.
Yeah, you know, as we look at the present day for these three companies we're going to be discussing today, we kind of want to look at what we're most excited about. And I would argue for both of us, but please speak up, Captain Spike, if you feel otherwise. I would say here at Game Buoy, we're probably most excited about the fact that Namco Bandai is going to be partnering with Sora to develop the next Smash Brothers games for Wii U and 3DS. We mentioned that on a previous episode.
Yeah, and you know, as we discussed then, my understanding is that this is really to prevent the development of the next set of Smash Brothers games from being another 4 or 5 year, you know, epic development time.
Right. Anything that will involve Smash Brothers getting to us sooner, I'm in approval of. And you know, Namco had also, you know, established a relationship with Nintendo with the Mario Kart GP series of arcade games that you still see every couple of years. Are there two right now, I think? They've done two so far.
Yeah,
which
done
are,
two.
Which are fun, and, you know, they have Pac-Man characters and such. And it's kind of a good point. You know, Tekken games, Time Crisis games are still coming out, so, I mean, despite the fact that here in the U.S., anyway, the state of arcade gaming is just really a shade of what it used to be.
Yeah, it's kind of a meme at this point to bemoan it, but there is just not much of an active arcade scene these days outside of the super hardcore competitive types.
Right, but I mean, you know, if you go to an arcade, you'll probably see, like, the newest or a recent Tekken. You'll see Time Crisis. I mean, Namco is really, you know, kind of done well as far as adapting to the evolving market, I would say.
So overall, we here at Game Buoy think that Namco Bandai is generally doing well.
Yeah, pretty good job, NB.
They not Natasha Bedingfield. Middle ground. They sort of touched the top tier in that 2002 period, and now in 2012, maybe they lost a little bit of their luster, but they're still getting the job done.
Yeah, and definitely,
and, you know, they're working with Masahiro Sakurai-san, whom we're huge fans of here at Game Buoy Studios.
Oh yeah, I mean,
so hopefully, you know, hopefully they're gonna launch into the stratosphere.
You know, now, I think of any third party to pair with for Smash Brothers, Namco Bandai is gonna be a good partnership.
You know, you say of any, and I think this might be the ultimate segue. I feel super good about this segue. I feel like the only studio that might have been better suited to work on the Smash Brothers series would have been Capcom.
Well, yeah. But, you know, let's take a look at Capcom.
Yes, that is what I wanted you to do with that.
Well, my goodness. If you go back in your time machines to 1992, I mean, Capcom, at that point, 1992, 5 years prior, they had introduced Street Fighter and Mega Man, of course, two of their most successful franchises ever. You know, at this point, 1992 would still be a few years before we saw Resident Evil. 1992 is when Street Fighter II came out on SNES, which is where I remember playing it. So, I mean, for many of our listeners, probably this era, Street Fighter II, still a fan favorite. You know, we got the HD remix a couple years back as a digital download. So, I mean, pretty big year for them. Mega Man 5 came out that year as well. And we touched on this a little bit last week with our underappreciated gems discussion. They put out some really great Disney-based platformers, including Darkwing Duck, which I don't think we really spent a lot of time talking about. We said Chip and Dale. DuckTales is the big one. And just a lot of great games. There was a Tailspin one that they did. And
that's one that we didn't bring up last week, in fact.
Yeah, and one that I really wish I had brought up is one of my all-time favorite NES games, Little Nemo the Dream Master, which was 1990. And then, of course, at this era, 1992 is when Gargoyle's Quest 2 came out.
Oh, man. Have you played that yet?
I haven't, but of course, last week, Captain Spike was talking about Demon's Crest.
Which is the third game in that series.
Which is the third game. So 1992 was pretty good era, and not too far off from the launch of Mega Man X.
Yeah, if you're listening to this show, I think more likely than not, you probably fucking loved Capcom circa 1992.
Gosh, and you know, I when I have issue with Capcom, which we'll get to, and you know, it's not so bad, but we think back to this era, 1992, you know, roughly in the middle of their prominence in the market, you know, just so much quality gaming coming out of them. But, you know, even still, 2002, jumping 10 years forward from that, a year before that, 2001, is a game that actually started as a Resident Evil game in development. Of course, Resident Evil was about 1996-ish. But Devil May Cry originally started out as a
sequel to Resident Evil, yeah.
Resident Evil 2, I think, had just come out, and then they started development, and it ended up being Devil May Cry. You know, I'm not a huge fan of the Devil May Cry series, but these games, of course, were the root for Kamiya's later masterpiece, Bayonetta. And, you know, we here at Game Buoy love Kamiya-san.
Huge fans of Kamiya. In fact, you said his name, and I wanted to be like, did you say Kamiya?
Right? Beautiful Joe for GameCube.
And oh, man. What such a good game.
Yeah, and really just such a great creative voice, which we'll get into Kamiya-san again in a little bit. But something else that I'd like to point out very briefly is that in 2005, so, you know, a few years after our point in history we're looking at, Killer7 was published by Capcom, and of course that was made by Grasshopper. And if you're not...
Of course, Suda Goichi.
Yeah, Suda 51.
And it's funny, you know, Suda Goichi, he put out a few games prior that.
True.
But for some reason, Killer 7, Smith's references and all, just really sort of set the whole gaming world's eyes onto this man and his boutique development.
Right. Studio. So I mean, we have Capcom to thank for publishing that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, again, same with Devil May Cry,
and Beautiful Joe. You know. So at this point, I guess what we're saying is that they were really supporting great creative voices in the industry at this time.
That's really where I was trying to push.
Yeah,
it.
But
I know you have more to say about this time period, but I really wanted to make the point that 2002, Capcom was absolutely top tier, AAA, really doing it, trying new things, taking
yeah,
risks,
and you know
putting
you
their creative
you think of
in the forefront.
You think of 2002, you're like GameCube, but no, I mean like Beautiful Joe, and Donkey Konga, this is why I will always stand by the GameCube, because sure, there was a lot of crap, but there was a lot of crap for everyone, but for Namco and for Capcom, great era. But, unfortunately, this was also when we were starting to see Mega Man kind of as a thing slowing down significantly. Pretty much that era, slightly before that, was the Mega Man Legends, beginning of the Mega Man Legends series. And we'll talk about that a little bit later when we get to the present day. And I'm sure you know what we're going to talk about. But there was Mega Man Zero for GBA in 2002. And then Mega Man X7 was around that time. And then there was like the Battle Network games. I don't really know anything about those. But, kind of also interesting to look at is that Street Fighter III had come out about 5 years prior. And... I know Captain Spike has a special place in his heart for 3.
It needs to be said, and I think more people do now than not. Most of us now like Street Fighter 3, but at the time, it was kind of a flop.
Yeah, so, it's kind of interesting to look at that.
Oh,
and then,
yeah, I'm looking at your table, and you actually mentioned it was not a success. I'm sorry, continue.
No, just interestingly, Marvel vs. Capcom 1 and 2, which is, of course, why I'm sure you mentioned why they would be great to work on a Smash Brothers game. But,
well, yes, but continue.
Marvel vs. Capcom 1 hit in 98, of course, based on Street Fighter versus Marvel. Street Fighter versus X-Men, right? Or X-Men versus Street Fighter. I'm terrible. But Marvel vs. Capcom 1, 98. Marvel vs. Capcom 2 in the year 2000. But we really wouldn't see anything in the Street Fighter world or the Marvel vs. Capcom world until the present day, which we'll get to in a minute. But there was one little surprise hit that came out, and we just talked about it earlier in our news, Ace Attorney. And, that came out in 2001 for the DS, and as we said, Ace Attorney 5 is coming out. So that was a very surprising little hit, because, you wouldn't think that a game about trials and such and a court of law would be a hit. But, it's just got a great little following. And then, of course, and this is almost the perfect segue, because shortly after our 2002 point in history, 2004 is when Monster Hunter began. And, of course, arguably, that's what's keeping Capcom afloat largely, particularly... in Japan.
See, I would not... I think that is absolutely not true.
Well...
I practically have...
I take it back. I don't think that they're keeping it afloat, but people in Japan love them some Monster Hunter. And so, anything else to say before we launch back into the present day, Captain Spike?
No, I'll tackle your argument in
okay,
that
and
period.
And I was kind of just wording it wrong. I don't think that it's Monster Hunter that's keeping them... afloat, but we look at the present day for Capcom. Street Fighter 4, very successful. Marvel vs. Capcom 3, very successful. But Japanese people.
And you know what? I'm gonna cut in here. I'm gonna go off script because I want to talk about some other Capcom games that have been successful. I want to talk about Resident Evil 5.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I want to talk about Resident Evil 6.
Yeah, and I mean, I was going to touch on that.
There are a lot of people, don't get me wrong, that have problems with these games, but they're still buying them. You know, Street Fighter 4, which we briefly mentioned, but it's worth mentioning. I mean, there were multiple different releases of these games that all just sold brilliantly.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and I was actually going to touch on that later.
Street Fighter versus Tekken hit, you know, and we've
talked... Street Fighter versus Tekken, yeah.
We've talked about how the sales were disappointing. We've talked about how the sales were somewhat disappointing for that title here, but somewhat disappointing when you're expecting, like, 5 million and you get, like, 1.7 million.
Yeah.
Like, that's still a lot. They have, you know, the Lost Planet series, which,
yes,
while the second game flopped a little bit, the first game was enormously successful.
Speaking of which,
we have
Lost
the Dead
Planet,
Rising
Lost
series.
Planet 3, let me just pause you right here. Lost Planet 3 is going to be coming out January 15th, so that's coming out very soon.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, Dead Rising, I was actually going to get to these, but that's fine.
It's, you know, it's, again, I just had to disagree that Monster Hunter is somehow their lifeline.
And I'm sorry, that was not the right way to phrase it, but you do have to admit, Japan goes crazy for Monster Hunter.
Oh, sure facts.
And I mean, they probably, Nintendo probably owes a lot to them for 3DS sales, and it looks like with the Monster Hunter 3 Ultimate, or as it's known in Japan, Tri-G, is going to be hitting Wii U at launch, as we mentioned a couple episodes back. And, you know, we're going to get those in March of next year, and that's when Monster Hunter 4 hits. So, Monster Hunter, and no, I definitely agree. Capcom's had a lot of success with different IPs, but, I mean, Japan, my point is, Japan loves Monster Hunter, and, you know, it's just really, I think they're really putting a lot of effort into building up this franchise, which, unfortunately, the opposite could be said for Mega Man. You know, we recently saw Mega Man 9 and 10, which, you know, great little retro games. I mean, very worthy of being called 9 and 10, I'd argue. But, of course, Mega Man Legends 3 was canceled, and we honestly don't know what's going to happen with Mega Man. I mean, and honestly, you know, all the time I'm like, oh, what's with Capcom these days? But I think, honestly, a lot of it has to do with just how they've treated Mega Man.
Yeah, and you know, that is...
And
I'm
know...
very concerned, because Mega Man will be celebrating a pretty big anniversary this year.
25th, right?
Yeah, yeah, and we haven't heard anything about that yet. But Capcom has insisted that this awful iOS Mega Man crossover game is not the anniversary celebration, and that we will have a better idea of what is the anniversary celebration by the end of the year.
Well,
so
hopefully
I'm
it'll
trying,
be the...
it's Capcom, and you know, it's sort of twofold. You know, I acknowledge what you were talking about. There is definitely a perception that Capcom is doing awful.
And but they're actually not.
That's because a lot of us feel like they are treating us personally awful.
Yeah.
By making business choices like canceling Mega Man Universe, canceling Mega Man Legends 3.
That's right, Mega Man Universe.
They didn't bring Ace Attorney Investigations 2 over because of the high DS piracy rate. They didn't feel it would be worth translating and releasing there. But the thing I have to say, as much as all of those things bother me, they're all really, really, really good business decisions.
Yeah.
Except Mega Man Legends 3. That one I think they dropped
the
ball on.
So honestly, like,
but,
even over on...
Universe looked awful. Before it was canceled, everyone was bellyaching, like, oh, God, what is this? This looks awful. It wasn't until they canceled it that we all started crying about it.
You're like, no. But, yeah, you know, even over on Nerdgasm Network, I've been like, really, Capcom? Really? But it's honestly been a lot to do with Mega Man. Although there are some other interesting
interesting points. I didn't mean to interrupt, but, points. You know, I always have things to say.
If you listen to this show frequently, you already know a lot about Keiji Inafune, and we've talked about him. Of course, he's currently at Comcept, but
just a few years back, 2010, he was named global head of production at Capcom, but 6 months later, he left to form Concept. And, you know, obviously a huge loss for Capcom. Do you have any insight? Because I'm not too familiar with why he left to form Concept. Are you familiar with the motivation behind it?
Unfortunately, all we really know about that is kind of hearsay.
Yeah, that's what I figure.
We all assume it's related to Mega Man. We all assume it's related to them sort of pigeonholing him and, you know, keeping him sort of hands off on active development and design, because we know he's very passionate about game design. And you'd have to be to have made the games and made the mark that he has made on the games that he has.
Right.
But I don't have any insight that I could really say from a factual perspective. Just sort of the general thought is it relates to his hands being tied and wishing he could be doing more and doing different things.
Right. So, I mean, we definitely think Capcom is worse off. Whether he was pushed out or it was of his own choice, you know, we think Capcom is worse off not having Inafune-san amongst its ranks. And similarly, a couple years back, Capcom also shut down Clover Studios, which of course was where Kamiya-san and company put out Resident Evil 2, the Devil May Cry games, Beautiful Joe, Okami, you know, just some...
You didn't mention it here, but God Hand.
God Hand, yes, which was critically, like, panned, but I know a lot of people who are very passionate about God Hand.
Well, that's one that really, because it's so intricately designed and it's very demanding, it reviewed awful. IGN gave it like a 3 or something.
Yeah, or even worse. I remember that the IGN review was just kind of a joke among the hardcore fanboys because, you know, they're just like...
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the kind of rating you give to Barbie for NES.
Excuse me? No. But, you know, we think that was definitely creative. You know, business-wise, you know, they probably had their reasons, but creatively, we think it was a huge loss. But, and you know what, it's definitely their loss because...
We don't have it again. I'm going to go a little off script. But, you know, who else they drove out with their business choices?
Who did they drive out?
And this is obviously a few years ago, but we're talking about a few years ago anyway, right, this moment.
Right.
Was Shinji Mikami.
Oh, yeah.
You know, who left after the debacle for Resident Evil 4. You know, it was announced as a GameCube exclusive game.
Yeah, that's right.
And he had said that, you know, he swore to the gaming press in Japan that if that game was ever ported to another console, he would commit harakiri. And
wow,
the game was announced for PS2, the port, and the port is let's be frank, the port for Resident Evil 4 on PS2, it plays okay, but on a technical level it is an ugly mess.
God awful.
Awful. And Shinji Mikami-san, he basically resigned shortly after that. He did not commit harakiri, but he basically did end his career at Capcom and ended up going with the Clover guys, which is what made me think of this. He was with Platinum Games, and he was actually the lead on Vanquish.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah, and of you course,
can,
you
can
know,
pick
we
pick the thread back up from there.
You know, speaking of Platinum, we think that, you know, it's Capcom's loss because Kamiya and folks over at Platinum, we here at Game Buoy think that they're putting out some of the finest games in the Japanese market right now. I mean, or finest games in the world, arguably. We love us some Bayonetta, as you know. And, you know, so I guess what we're trying to say is that Capcom's financially doing very well, but, you know, we like Street Fighter, we like Marvel vs. Capcom. I have nothing against Monster Hunter, just not too familiar with it. And, you know, same with Resident Evil, Dead Rising, Lost Planet. But creatively, we think the fact that they've lost so many creative voices in the past couple of years is, you know, at least significant to note. Take from that what you will, but...
And, you know, again, I want to point out to... I want to just reiterate, obviously, Capcom is making brilliant choices financially.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You could even... I think you could even make an argument that while they lost some of their most creative voices among their ranks and their staff, the argument could be made that they made the right call. And in a lot of ways, Kamiya-san, Inafune-san, Mikami-san, these guys have all gone on to work on just some really great, great titles.
That's true. So while we could say, you know, that the, you know, especially with shutting down Clover, we just are so disappointed. But, you know, honestly, first of all, if they hadn't done that, we wouldn't have had Platinum, arguably. So it's
Kamiya-san has said this himself, if Capcom hadn't closed them down, he would not have ever made Bayonetta.
So
he
has very openly
acknowledged this.
So while I guess what we're saying is while we recognize that, you know, these creative voices are gone and that Capcom may be worse off for it, we almost have to thank them
for cultivating these voices in
the first place. That's what I was exactly going to say. So, you know,
and I'm being a little bit of a ninja here because I feel like, you know, you wrote this beautiful table that I've referenced several times in this episode because you really did a superb job on it. Except your prognosis on Capcom, and I think I've made this clear by now, is a little different from mine. I see, for example, and this is a great example, I look at this Devil May Cry game that is in development
now. Oh, Lord.
And, you know, I think it looks like a hot mess. But I have to give Capcom credit for going to all of these different studios and, you know, sometimes their collaborations with American or Canadian or European studios, sometimes it doesn't work out so well, like Lost Planet 2. But sometimes you end up with, like, a Dead Rising 2. And I think it's probably good that they're reaching out and, like, with this Devil May Cry game, I'm disappointed. I think it doesn't look as good as Devil May Cry 3 was or Devil May Cry 4.
But I guess at least they're trying.
They're trying. Exactly. They're trying. They cultivated some of what I feel are the most amazing voices in the industry, and they continue to try to do that. And I think that's worth something. I think there's merit there.
I think where it's at for me, though, is just, you know, we were talking with Namco Bandai that we're super excited about their partnership with Sora for Smash Brothers. I just really can't think of anything that I'm personally super excited for as far as Capcom's concerned, like in the next year, you know?
I'm a Kanye you. Darkstalkers.
Oh, wow.
If I had a mic, I would have just dropped it.
You do have a mic, and I'm glad you did not drop it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right?
No, I totally wasn't even thinking of that, even though we talked about it last week. Yeah, so I'm honestly, if they had not, if they weren't trying to bring back Darkstalkers and all, it would have maybe looked a little uncertain for me personally.
Yeah, it's, you know.
You know, we like we said, Monster Hunter.
One thing I like about Capcom. 3
is going to be out here next year.
One thing I like about Capcom, and I'm sorry, I know I keep interrupting you.
No, it's fine.
But I appreciate that when people ask Capcom, you know, about this franchise that's sleeping, that franchise that's sleeping, Capcom will often acknowledge them and say, oh, we're still evaluating for opportunities to, you know, bring that back to the marketplace. And a lot of people are like, oh, well, show me the games, show me the Ace Attorney Investigations 2, show me the Phoenix Wright 4, whatever. But then you look at, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, through this collaboration with Gree, for example.
Right.
They're doing that, you know, all Capcom World crossover game that has, like, Breath of Fire represented, and it has Onimusha represented.
Which is cool.
And it has Mega Man represented. And so I have to feel like, to some degree, Capcom sees what they have and they're just trying to keep making good choices so that they don't go under, because unfortunately a lot of the big Japanese names have really gone out of business in the last decade.
I mean, just look at what's happened to Sega.
Well, yeah, we've good news though, you know, good news on the Sega front very currently, but yeah, Sega has been in hot water and dodging, you know, sort of a guillotine at their neck for years. Capcom is not. They're keeping their head afloat, they're taking risks when they can, and they're taking the sure bets where they are so that they can take the occasional risk. And I just think there's a lot of respect to that. We didn't talk about, for example, Tatsunoko versus Capcom. Like, who else would have made that?
That even got released over here, didn't it?
Yeah, they went out of their way to license some of these anime properties. My understanding is that it was a very complex set of issues to get that game brought to the U.S. They had to do relicensing of certain things, certain series they couldn't license in the U.S., so they made new characters for those slots for the U.S. release.
Really? I didn't realize that.
So, I mean... Huh. Again, for all the hate Capcom gets, and, you know, they do some jank stuff. They do on-disc DLC, which we've talked about on this show. I don't mind, but a lot of people do. They do a lot of stuff that people find very unsavory, but I have to come in and white knight defend Capcom. I think they're a great company. I think they have a great long-term plan, and I think they do what they can to do respect to their franchises.
We as fanboys might be a little hurt by some of their decisions, or... be like, oh, how could you do that? But, I mean, honestly, we just have to look at it from a business standpoint. And, I mean, looking at our 3 points, 1992, 2002, 2012, very successful at all 3 points.
I would say that Capcom has been one of the premier Japanese developers and publishers for all of these time periods. They were in 1992, they were in 2002, and I would argue that they still are in 2012 with a bright outlook for the future.
True, and I think any sort of hurt feelings or whatever that we have in the present day are only because we love Capcom so much. I mean, especially all these games we were mentioning, you know. So we just don't like to see them not using some of their greatest IPs.
I'm gonna take the ball from you, and I'm gonna say that we go from one company that we disagreed on. You thought that they maybe were not as good as they used to be, and I was like, nope. To one that we can definitely agree is not as awesome as they used to be.
Oh yeah, so we're of course talking about Konami. You know, it's so sad that we have to laugh about Konami, because if we take a trip back to 1992, at this point, they were one of the most prolific third-party studios for the NES. I mean, you think of Castlevania, Contra, Metal Gear, Gradius. You know, last week on our Underappreciated Gems episode, we talked about Tiny Toons and similarly Bucky O'Hare. And, you know... Konami was so prolific that back in this era, Nintendo of America, we kind of mentioned them being a little bit bitchy. They limited third-party studios to 5 games a year. So in America, they established a subsidiary called Ultra Games. And, you know, Ultra Games, that's where they put out Metal Gear in the U.S. and Gyrus, Skate or Die, and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle games, and... speaking of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle games, those are some of the most beloved arcade games of that era. I mean, if you think of those TMNT games at the arcade, those are the definitive versions, I would argue. And so, you know, just a really prolific studio at that time. Captain Spike, huge Castlevania fan. I argue that many gamers have fond memories of Contra, and, you know, Metal Gear got its start back then. So, you know, just really, really prolific. Do you have any thoughts about 1992-era Konami?
You know, not quite 1992, but sort of close to that date. They released what is one of my very favorite games of all time. And I never talk about it. I didn't talk about it on our Unsung Games because it's one of those games that everyone who knows what it is loves.
So it's not underappreciated.
It's not underappreciated, no, because if you know what it is, you love it. And this was released in the U.S. in 1994.
Okay, so slightly after.
Yes, I'm talking about Snatcher. Snatcher was a cyberpunk-themed graphic adventure game.
Huh.
It was made by Hideo Kojima.
Ah.
Most well-known at this point for, of course, the Metal Gear games.
Yes.
And it was basically like, you could say, Blade Runner the game.
Wow.
It is just this really incredible... really incredible adventure game, and it's a graphic adventure game in the way that now we would probably call it a visual novel.
Hmm, interesting.
It was fully voiced, and it's like an interactive anime movie.
I'm sorry, what platform was this for?
This was released in the U.S. for the Sega CD.
Okay, I was going to say, when you said fully voiced, I kind of figured it was that.
It was, of course, originally released in Japan in 88, actually, for the PC and the MSX console.
Well, okay.
I say MSX console, but it was really a computer platform that was just sort of standardized.
Huh.
So,
okay.
and the PC engine, you know, the TurboGrafx, in Japan, had a CD-based remake. And that is what the Sega CD version is a port of, is that PC Engine CD remake with voices and just beautiful music. You can play through the whole game in like 3.5 hours, but it's a really intense 3.5 hours of just the most awesome Hideo Kojima having crazy wild ideas. And when I think of, you know, early 90s, Konami, that's what I think of, is like this really, like, let's do things that are different, and let's do things that are daring, and let's give high production values to this visual novel that is not even a real genre yet, so that Hideo Kojima can achieve his dream of telling these super science fiction
stories.
Yeah, and
I would argue, I mean, please chime in if you disagree, but whereas I would say Capcom was a little more accessible to a wider audience, I would say that Konami was a little grittier.
In those days, definitely. I mean, we all love Contra, and we all, you know about Contra, but if you look at Contra, compared to anything Capcom made, let's look at four games that Konami made in this period. Gradius, Castlevania, Contra, Metal Gear.
Let's look at some games Capcom did.
Then you look at some games Capcom did. You have, like, Mega Man.
Which is still very cutesy.
Which is, yeah, and then, you know, Capcom did, like, DuckTales and Chicken Tail. And I guess my point is that if you compare these games side by side, the Konami games are way more demanding. They're way more, if not exactly complex, than you could still say less straightforward.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, Mega Man is complex as hell.
I wouldn't call Mega Man complex as hell.
Level design is pretty, pretty intricate, but... Anyway, you know, anything else to say about 1992 era Konami?
Just, I think about Konami in that era, and they're probably one of my three favorite developers. They were making really incredible games that I'm really passionate about that make me ranty.
And I mean, the Konami code, bitches. Hello.
Hello.
So, you know, we talked about their how prolific they were in the for the NES, and then, you know, of course, some of their arcade gems like TMNT, Turtles in Time, and all that. But fast forwarding 10 years to the future is really when arcade was just huge for them. Of course, I'm talking about Bimani, Beatmania. Poppin' Music, Paradise, which is not to be confused with the Coldplay song, Guitar Freaks, and of course, Dance Dance Revolution. I mean, this just dominated the Konami lineup. We have them to thank for Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice. You know, just huge, 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 huge. I mean, when we think of Konami 10 years ago, we immediately think of DDR and all these other super fun rhythm games that, you know, if you spent any time in arcades back then, you certainly were at least playing DDR, but, you know, hopefully popping music, hopefully some para-para, Guitar Freaks, which, I mean, you know, we have Guitar Freaks to thank. I'd like to argue for Guitar Hero and Rock Band. You know, they were kind of the first to really be successful with that. But, you know, this was also the era when we saw Suikoden, Silent Hill, and then another one that...
and sort of continuing with what I was just saying of really treading new ground.
Yeah, and I mean...
really cool, weird things.
Yeah, including another one that I never had a lot of experience with, but I'm sure many would consider an underappreciated gem, Vandal Hearts and its sequel. And then, you know, of course, Metal Gear Solid was this era, so, you know, just even though we immediately think of Bimani when we think of 2002-era Konami, you know, still very, very successful franchises in the console market. Now, as far as Castlevania is concerned, you're more of the Castlevania expert here, and I mean, from what I understand, Symphony of the Night is really where it hit its peak, and that was a couple years prior to our point in history we're looking at.
Yeah, you can't really call me a Castlevania expert.
Because, compared to me.
Because I do love Castlevania. I love, 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 love Castlevania.
Then why don't you marry it?
I would if it were legal.
Anyways, I'm sorry. Please continue.
The meme, of course, is that Castlevania... The meme is that Castlevania reached its peak with Symphony of the Night. And I'm sorry, I'm sort of trying to think about how to phrase this, but I'm of the opinion, you know, Koji Igarashi-san, who has been leading these Castlevania games since then, and he, of course, the first game he worked on was Rondo of Blood, which recently got its first release in the U.S. I believe we talked about that either on this show or possibly the Pirate Radio shows that we had done prior to Game Buoy. I am of the belief that the real pinnacle of the Castlevania games, especially post-Symphony, would actually be the DS game Order of Ecclesia.
Okay, well, that's a little bit ahead of our point. We're still at 2002, Captain Spike.
Yes, I know that, but you were talking about Castlevania reaching its peak, and I was telling you...
Okay, fair enough.
I don't think that was its peak.
Well, I mean, in this era of Castlevania, though, would you agree?
And I want to talk about it in this context because it will make it easier to tie into one of the notes I know you're going to hit in 2012. That's why I wanted to bring it up before we got to 2012. But yeah, I mean, looking at Castlevania within the context of 2002...
Because Castlevania games were put out pretty much every other year at that point, right?
More or less. You know, it really was revived with the Game Boy Advance when Circle of the Moon hit. Prior to that, there was not a lot of action between Symphony of the Night and Circle of the Moon. But Circle of the Moon hit. It followed up on this whole Metroidvania style, which obviously that was sort of defined and really became a thing with Symphony of the Night, which Symphony of the Night is an amazing game. I don't want to downplay how amazing that game is. It's a perfect example of Konami letting one of their creative voices just, oh, you want to do this? Do it. Pull a Kojima and let's. He wanted to make a voiced adventure game that's like an anime Blade Runner. You can make a Castlevania game that plays like Metroid.
Yeah. So you would agree that in this era, if not the best Castlevania of that era, definitely notable. So, you know, of course, that was a little bit before our point in time, but, you know, so we had...
Yeah, I'm just getting my wires a little crossed because I'm so disappointed by what's happened to Konami.
Right, and we'll get to that in a minute. One thing before we launch into the present day is 1999, again, a little before our point in history we're looking at, Survival Kids came out for Game Boy Color, and we'll pick up on that in just a minute.
I feel like you're only bringing that up because you have a crush on someone that likes that game, because I don't think that game is worth talking about in any other context.
No, unless, is there somebody that I like who likes Survival Kids? Because not that I'm aware of, but I am going to talk about something involving a romantic interlude in a little bit.
Go for it.
It's relevant, but but that involves the present day. So, anything to launch into? Anything else to touch on before we?
Nope. Just
move to 2012.
1992, Konami making cool hardcore games.
2002,
still making cool hardcore games. Also making cool casual games that break new ground.
Bimani.
And cultivating, you know, creative voices and going in new directions and basically refining genres that previously didn't exist. Which brings us to 2012.
Speaking of things not existing, 2012, Bimani.
Well played.
Bimani Fever definitely has died down. I mean, at least here in the U.S. You know,
even in Japan, as I understand it.
Yeah.
I do understand that they are...
They're going to reboot it, right?
Yeah, that's what I hear, because reboots are what we do now.
Yeah, but I mean... and, you know, we could have a lot to say about, you know, the state of arcade gaming, and we might even have to have a whole discussion about this on a future episode. But, you know, Bimani just really... not super popular here anymore. And, you know, the reason that I had actually brought up Survival Kids is that in the past couple of years, we've had that series revived for DS, known over here as Lost in Blue. And the reason that I wanted to bring that up is besides Lost in Blue, and then once in a while you'll get something like Elebits, really they're just putting out games like Silent Hill, which are pretty much crap as far as I understand.
And, you know, I just had a conversation. Funny you should bring up Silent Hill. I just had a conversation.
Yes, with Rob Roberts from OLR.
Radio. Yes. OLR for short. Just last night about what's happened to Silent Hill. Because, you know, I'm a huge fan personally of the Silent Hill Wii game, Shattered Memories.
Yeah.
But aside that, I basically think every Silent Hill of the last 5 years has been complete ass. I loved Silent Hill 1, 2 especially, 3 is pretty good. I love 4. I like Shattered Memories. And then, but pretty much everything else I just has been like nails on a chalkboard for me.
Yeah, and I mean, I heard that Downpour, which is the one that came out this year, had its moments, but, you know.
You know, I didn't, I'll admit, I played it, I didn't put in as much time as I could have, because I was put off strongly by it very early on in. And it was like, you know what, I'm not feeling this, I'm going to spend my time better by playing games that I actually like.
Yeah, and what we want to compare that to is, you know, so I mean, basically we here at Game Boy think Silent Hill these days, but similarly 2 years ago we saw Castlevania Lords of Shadow, which was a 3D platformer. They kind of were speaking of rebooting, they were trying to reboot the franchise. You know, I know people who liked it, but my boyfriend at the time was playing through it and he was pretty basic. He doesn't listen to this podcast, so I can say he was pretty basic.
You know, there was one incredible level in Lords of Shadow. There is one incredible level that feels like a Castlevania game, and it is just amazing. And that's the credit I give it.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it feels like a non-Castlevania generic survival horror action game that has had vague Castlevania elements sort of copy-pasted over it.
So, I mean, just really Silent Hill.
For those of you out there listening, I'm talking about the music box level. You know what that means, and if you don't, I suggest you YouTube it, because you'll probably get it if you have passion for the series like I do.
So, yeah, we have Silent Hill, meh. Castlevania, meh. Although, what's that Castlevania game that I've seen you play? It was the Xbox Live Arcade game.
That was Harmony of Despair. Harmony of Despair was actually released in 2010 for Xbox Live Arcade, and that was a Koji Igarashi game. It's like a co-op online, almost like a Diablo 2D Castlevania action Diablo game.
Yeah, it's not a bad little game.
I like it quite a bit because I've watched
Captain Spike play it, and then sometimes he's had to run and do something, and I played it for him. So I thought that was worth mentioning because, you know, while we had a pretty dreadful 3D Castlevania platform, we had this neat little 2D thing, which actually is relevant to next year for Castlevania. We've got a really cool looking 2D style platform in 3D for the 3DS. We're of course talking about Castlevania Lords of Shadow: Mirror of Fate, which we mentioned on a previous episode, and I mean, we're pretty excited about that here at Game Buoy.
You know, my opinion has turned a little bit on
that. Has
it? It has. The more videos and trailers I see of it, that game, the more it looks like sort of that whole generic action God of War style
game,
but with 2D platforming sequences in between. I'm still going to give the game the benefit of the doubt, but seeing that it's that kind of 3D action in between platforms...
Okay, yeah, that's... I wasn't aware of that, because I honestly hadn't been following it recently.
My hype is on that game is definitely going down.
Oh, well, you know, but it still could be a little bit of fun, but what we're not anticipating is going to be so great is Lords of Shadow 2, which is going to actually pick up after Mirror of Fate. And presumably, I don't know much about Lords of Shadow 2, but I presume it's going to be more of what we saw in Lords of Shadow. You know, just a generic 3D platforming spooky couture.
And, you know, I should say, to be fair to Lords of Shadow 2, if they could do more stages in Lords of Shadow 2 like the music box in Lords of Shadow, it could be good.
Yeah, but bottom line, Castlevania, kind of on shaky ground, we'd say.
I would say it's on extremely shaky ground.
Silent Hill.
We have no indication that Igarashi-san is doing another Metroidvania game. And I frankly think that that is a goddamn shame. I have talked about that on this show. I definitely talked about that on our pre-show pirate episodes that we did for Geeks for Fans. I think the world is worse off with no new Igarashi fronted Metroidvania style games.
Definitely. So, you know, Silent Hill, shaky ground. Castlevania, shaky ground. Metal Gear, we'd like to talk for a moment.
I have something to add to what you're about to say, and I want to say it first because it might sort of interrupt you.
Okay.
This week, Zone of Enders HD Collection came out.
Okay.
And this is so cute. You know, Zone of Enders, when it originally came out, most people bought it because it had a playable demo of Metal Gear Solid 2, which was a huge deal at the time. And where this becomes relevant is that Zone of Enders HD Collection comes with a playable demo of Metal Gear Rising. Which, of course, I believe you are about to go into talking about.
Yeah, it's due out here February 19th, and then 2 days later in Europe and Japan, Metal Gear Rising Revengeance. And the reason that we're actually looking forward to this Konami-published title is because it was almost canceled during development, but Platinum Games came in and saved the day. They've rebuilt it as kind of, what I understand, a Bayonetta-style game. And, you know, originally, you know, so Platinum really overhauled it. It was originally, I understand, supposed to be set between Metal Gear Solid 2 and 4, since 3 was, like, a big prequel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I have to admit,
3 is an amazing game. Just
I have to admit that I am not familiar with Metal Gear
I have
Solid.
The HD collection. You should
borrow
it.
I really should give it a try. But, so it's now a sequel to 4, correct?
Yeah, yeah. It takes place after 4 now.
And it's focusing on Raiden, who kind of polarizing, from what I understand, to the...
Very polarizing. Oh, girl, I wish you had been there when Metal Gear Solid 2 came out.
Well, he's a little bit... he's a little bit metrosexual, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he's full-on B-shoujo. He was very specifically designed...
And, I mean, we think of Solid Snake, you know, our daddy's dad, who's, like, very...
And he is very, like... He's almost like a Yoshitaka Amano design. Like, right. He's a girly man.
But, I mean, I think it's kind of telling...
Girly man! Okay, now you're being racist.
Okay.
We're getting a little punchy.
Yeah.
So it's a sequel to Metal Gear Solid 4. Having played this demo, I just gotta say... That is now what I'm most excited about on Konami's plate.
Yeah, and is it kind of sad that the most exciting thing from Konami is a Platinum game?
Yeah, right?
So, I mean, Konami, reboots that suck. ... What do you think, do you think that there's any hope for Konami? Or are we just kind of...
Well, and this is, you know, this is really... Konami is on a downward trend. They really flopped... They really flopped the entire Bimani series. Like, the Bimani sub-series... the Bimani series was made up of, like, 5 different sub-series, and they are basically all dead.
So sad.
They have all of these cool, weird little IPs that they started, in some cases built up fan bases for, and have completely done nothing
with. They haven't done shit with
all of
this,
right? When
was
the last time a fucking Suikoden game came out?
Yeah.
I say that there was one on the PSP, just not all that.
Yeah, but
long
I mean,
ago.
They could be doing a lot more with Suikoden, and, you know.
But they really could, yeah. You know, you look at the way that I strongly feel they have absolutely dropped the ball on Castlevania. Again, not for the console versions. I actually think that the whole 3D action game is a good take for a console Castlevania. I think there's a market for that. I think that if it's designed from the ground up as a Castlevania game, it could be good, which is, you know, what I was just saying about Lords of Shadow 2. It could be good. I think most of our trepidation comes from the fact that the original was a letdown. But, you know, killing off the 2D Metroidvania-style games on portable consoles, like, that's a problem.
You blew it.
Ever since the super well-received Contra 4 that they had WayForward do for the DS a few years back...
Oh, yeah.
They have completely dropped the ball on Contra, despite announcing a few years ago that they were going to make an announcement... shortly after, about a new Contra project, which they never did.
That's right. That did happen. Well, or should I say that failed to happen?
Yeah, that didn't happen. You know, they've been putting out Silent Hill games basically yearly. Instead of focusing on making one good one, they're pumping out mediocre Silent Hill after mediocre Silent Hill.
They're crapping out a bunch of dung.
Up to there now being a Vita game that hit a couple weeks ago. Silent Hill Book of Memories,
which is terabad.
Yeah, it's basically Diablo with guns and demons. Oh, and way less depth, if you can believe it.
Yeah, if it has way less depth than a Diablo game, yikes.
Yeah, so I think the only shining spot on their plate right now is Metal Gear Rising Revengeance.
Which isn't even developed by them, because they almost screwed that game over.
Yeah, when they were developing it internally, it was getting canceled.
So, once again, Platinum Games saves the day.
Right, man, I just love those guys so much.
Oh my god, yeah.
I think the public is really going to respond to Rising Revengeance, though. It plays great. It really does.
If that can be get people to be like, yeah, I need to check out The Wonderful 101, I need to check out Bayonetta 2, an original Bayonetta, and...
Everybody wins!
So basically, this is not a Platinum Games discussion tonight, so...
And, you know, the other game I'm really looking forward to is, of course, Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes, which we have talked about here on the show. And that's the one that Kojima Productions is doing. Kojima himself is doing it.
Oh, good.
And they just debuted it, you know, a couple months ago. It looks great. The visuals look really good, which that's not normally a huge draw for me. I'm not usually such a graphics guy. But the graphics look so good that I'm really, really taken by it and very interested in what they're doing. It's going to actually be like an open world game. It takes place immediately after Peace Walker, which I thought was an amazing game. And just everything Kojima is saying about it, it sounds really great.
Wonderful.
But that a barely announced
Metal Gear Solid game.
Metal Gear game is the only thing I can think of that I'm
excited about.
Aside from
a Metal Gear game that almost got canceled
aside from the Platinum one, like, that's awful. You're the fucking house of Gradius, Castlevania, Contra. All of these things, nope, not doing nothing. Silent Hill, Suikoden. It's just like, man, what are you guys doing?
So really, you know, I kind of have to put it in perspective when I think, like, Capcom, what are you doing? I'm like, no, Konami, what are you doing?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like,
Konami, what are you doing? Konami, stop!
Like, dude, I know we all want more Mega Man games, but by the same token, do we want Mega Man to be the new Silent Hill?
Ew!
Maybe canceling Universe and, God shoot me down for saying this, but canceling Legends 3, maybe this will ultimately result in a better Mega Man game getting made.
Let's hope so.
And
so,
if it does, then all credit to Capcom. As for Konami, son, I am disappointed.
Right, and, you know, we've said our piece here about these three companies. We would love to hear what you have to say. If you think we're totally wrong with Konami or any of the other publishers and developers we've discussed, we'd love to hear from you. So, you know, but we just wanted to take the opportunity to kind of take a look over the past 20 years and how these three companies have grown and, you know, the good and bad choices they've made. So, with that, I think it's time that we move into What's
Going On? All right, let's
So, hey, Captain Spike, what's up?
I will pay you money to never do that again. So I'm playing a couple games right now. I'm going to keep this quick. I'm going to talk super fast. I apologize if you can't make out what I'm saying. Ever since we were talking about Disgaea D2 last week,
yeah,
I popped Disgaea 3 back into my Vita.
Yeah, like right after we stopped recording.
Yeah, literally like minutes after we stopped recording. And I have in the last week played like 40-something hours of Disgaea 3.
Oh, so you're just only partway through.
Actually, I am I picked up my save from last time, and I'm now for the first time doing a complete run of all the content in the game, which means I'm grinding my characters into the thousands. I'm going into item worlds and grinding my levels so that my weapons levels are high.
So you're just basically grinding every day on the subway, aren't you? But not in the way that you might think.
Ew.
Especially if you know public transit out here.
But basically, yeah, hours a day just spent grinding battles, and I love it. It is giving me life.
Yeah, that seems right up your alley.
I also picked up Assassin's Creed Liberation, but my understanding is that you have some things to say about that game.
Yeah, so why don't you put that on pause?
Why don't you take it, and I'll just chime in where I gotta.
Yeah, so as you know, Assassin's Creed 3 and Assassin's Creed 3... Liberation just came out, the latter being for PlayStation Vita. So, you know, this is one game that I've particularly been looking forward to. I love the Assassin's Creed series. And so, you know, I was really looking forward to this game. I'm a couple hours in at this point, and, you know, I have to say, it's pretty faithful to the console Assassin's Creeds. I mean, especially when you consider that the portable Assassin's Creed offerings in the past have just been god-awful. But I have a few issues with it, and I know Captain Spike has some further different issues with it. You know, the first point is, it's not so much an issue personally for me. I can anticipate it being an issue with people. Two things. Eveline, am I saying her name right? Eveline?
I believe so.
She's a Creole woman in New Orleans.
Which is itself a big deal. She is a she.
Yes. but there are two aspects that I could foresee, like, kind of the social justice blogging community on the internet taking issue with. First of all, Evelyn can go into rooms to change her wardrobe. Now, the aspect of this is meant to be that, you know, she has different personas that can influence the gameplay. You know, like, as the lady, she's kind of like a high-class Southern belle who, you know, the guards won't give a hard time. As the assassin, you know, she obviously has a lot more at her arsenal. But there's also a persona that she has, which is the slave persona, which is the second issue that I could foresee people having a taking issue with. Now, I personally think that Ubisoft has done a pretty good job at being sensitive to different cultures. They've really tried to go out of their way. They, you know, they make a point at the beginning of their games, the loading screen, that this work was created by people with... It's a fictitious work based on history with a multicultural team. So, you know, they really try to be respectful of it. And, you know, I don't think that they've done anything outright offensive, but I can just see it being touchy. But speaking of touchy, I just realized that I fucking hate the rear touchpad on the Vita. And, gosh, I guess I'm just kind of having buyer's remorse with the Vita because I was really hoping that Liberation would kind of justify my purchase of a Vita. And, you know, it's not a terrible game, but, you know, it's unpolished to a point where I'm like, you know, it wasn't the...
Well, and, you know, in prep for this episode, I was telling you, and I'm going to repeat here for our listeners, but I have had that game crash fatally on me multiple times, and I've only played it for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand how Ubisoft shipped a game in that state. Like,
and you know, interestingly, Assassin's Creed 3 had to have day one patches because it was so glitchy, so yikes. But, yeah, you know, overall, I love the setting. It's so cool to climb around in, like, the bayou, and you have a... like little blow darts that you can use to...
yeah, I loved that whole blow dart mission and climbing through the trees. And
yeah, it's just really neat when we're so used to climbing around in Italy and before that in the Middle East. So, I mean, it just... And I really like Evelyn so far as a character, but I just... I'm concerned on one part that people write it off as... Oh, she's a girl and she plays dress-up. You know, the dress spheres in Final Fantasy X-2 had that same issue, despite being a really cool class system, as we talked about in our Final Fantasy game.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually had the social justice blogger meme happening in my life about this.
Really?
Well, you know, my partner worked on a game that got a lot of flack earlier this year, and I probably just gave it away, but I go out of my way never to talk about it, so I'm not going to talk specifically about what game that is. He was very upset, but I knew as soon as he showed me the trailer that drew this negative attention to the game, I told him, that's really misogynistic. I did not like that trailer, and it totally just turned me off of the game that you've been working on for the last several years. He was very disappointed to hear this, of course. And when they announced this persona system for Assassin's Creed Liberation, I told him again, like, this is a problem. Not that there is a persona system, that there's a dress-up and camouflage, and...
Which
that
I actually makes itself, complete sense. It's really cool.
That makes complete sense.
It's just so unfortunate that it had... The first game they introduced it... and had to be one with a female protagonist.
Yeah, like, dude, how come 50-year-old Ezio couldn't camouflage and disguise himself? Like, wouldn't that have been fucking useful? No, but the one where... Or how about the half-breed Indian in Assassin's Creed 3? No, it'd be super useful for him to dress up
and
hide.
Does he not have that same thing? It's just a Liberation
thing? Yes.
Okay, I haven't touched 3 yet.
And so that's... to be fair... I have only played 3 for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. So Maybe that system is introduced later in the game, but I definitely have not seen any sign of it yet, and I'm very disappointed why the game with the girl is the only one where you have a dress mechanic.
I
mean,
that said, I could foresee, you know, the fact that this is not part of Desmond's story, that's just kind of a separate adventure. This gives me hope overall for the future. I mean, I'm kind of that, you know, just exploring different worlds unrelated to that story. I think it could be great, especially if they do things like, you know, the Persona system or whatever they call it. But it's just, it's so unfortunate that they had to introduce it in a game starring a woman. And then also, and you know,
I am going to say, though, now that I've played the game, I still have these concerns from a deeper philosophical standpoint. I think there is maybe a little bit of inherent misogyny in this choice, but I don't think it's over the top or offensive. I think
I don't think that it's anything that should turn a well-informed gamer off of playing it. But you know, just similarly, I just also worry about the fact that she dresses up as a slave. I mean, when we consider, you know, if you remember the woman who freaked out over Jinx, the Pokemon, for resembling blackface, I am anticipating really a really touchy discussion about it. Even though I personally am on the side of Ubisoft, I think they've really been very respectful of different cultures throughout this whole series of games.
I actually agree, and again, that's. I think it's a cool system. I have concerns. I have concerns about the concerns.
Yeah.
But I see what they're trying to do there, and I just think it's unfortunate.
But yeah, I mean, overall, I'm going to still play through Liberation. I do not think that the rear touchpad gimmicks are cute at all. I had to, like, open a letter by sliding the front screen and the touch screen simultaneously. It took me like 5 tries just to get it to, like, it just the rear touch, and this might just be more of an issue with Vita. The rear touch just feels awkward, and you know, I don't like gimmicky things. So I'm hoping that the positive things that I've noticed about the game so far overweigh these concerns I've had. I'm just a little bit let down when I was really hoping to this to be really polished, and it's just not as polished as I was hoping. Any other thoughts about aside from your glitches?
No. I think we need to move on. I just saw the time.
Yeah, you know,
got things to do.
We're still kind of in mourning of those Lolotaku children, but in all seriousness, we're going to be bringing back that.
We have a new segment to replace that.
Yes, we're going to be bringing that back.
A Kotaku article I really want y'all to read. It's actually a good article, and that's why I want y'all to read it.
And we'll kind of touch on that next time, but
because Kotaku is down because of Hurricane Sandy,
although I guess all that we can say is that we're concerned about servers, but you know, presumably someone has to walk over those servers, so we hope they're all right. But you know, Kotaku's kind of in a bare bones mode right now. So for the sake of time, and
I'm just gonna throw out my shout outs, bro.
Yeah, why don't we get into it?
I got Koopa Club, basically us, gayer and more Nintendo-oriented. Check them out.
Men after my own heart.
We got Dorked, Matt Kaplan over there. Delightful little podcast, nice little audio parfait, only about 10 minutes an episode. Nice palate cleanser for, you know, your post-Game Buoy two-hour slog of old shit. And Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice. And from whom, as we so often tell you, we blatantly steal so many of our cues.
And, you know, always got to share our love for OLR. We just spent some time with Rob Roberts, and please go support them. They're actually in the running for a podcast award, and I feel horrible that I can't remember the name of the awards.
You are awful. And I can't look it up because my computer just shut itself down because I'm having technical issues.
Please go over to OLR's site, vote for them, support them, help them get recognition. I'd like to shout out to Nerdgasm Network. You know, they're the craziest, wackiest 3 hours, but not always, of Shock Jock Video Game Radio. I have so much fun anytime I go on there. Best Little Horde House in Azeroth and Girls Gone Wow. Two different but equally fun World of Warcraft podcasts. Video Game Outsiders, which, you know, we just love what they throw down. They're kind of up there with OLR, 7 years running. So hopefully we'll be there one day, too.
Well,
we'd love for you to check us out on Twitter at GameBuoy Podcast.
GameBuoy Podcast.
Facebook at Facebook.com/GameBuoy.
Facebook.com/GameBuoy.
You can email Captain Spike at cpt.spike@gamebuoy.org.
cpt.spike.gamebuoy.org.
cpt.spike@gamebuoy.org. And I'm sidekick@gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org. Gamebuoy.org. Gamebuoy.org.
Gamebuoy.org. Please give us ratings on iTunes. Subscribe to us on iTunes.
Interact comment with us.
Email us. Talk to us. We love you.
We need you. And with that, man, I think it's time.
I'm kind of hungry for a sandwich. Can we make that happen?
Yep. Keep gaming. Keep thinking. See you, Space Cowboy.
Adios.
Turning off my vibrator.